town crier days.
Right. Back when there was actual, like, community boards and bulletins and stuff. And
yeah. Yelling, you know, yelling, giving flyers.
Freedom isn't free.
Freedom ain't not free.
That's what they say. But I think that, yeah, we have about 30 seconds left. This is a good exercising of the minds, good discussions. This is our bread and butter over here. Yeah. Bread and butter.
Bread and butter.
Appreciate you.
Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Sonia, for engineering.
Yes. Thank you all so much for listening. I'm Tammy. This has been The Gap. We're reminding and we're bridging and we're filling. And Althea, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Sonia. And we will be back next week.
See you next week.
Bye for now.
KBOO is excited to be a part of the Willamette Week Give Guide this year. When you support KBOO through Give Guide, not only does it support your favorite community radio station, it also gives a little back to you in return. When you donate $10 or more, you'll get full access to hundreds of local coupons in the Chinook Book app, plus a few other goodies, available while supplies last. So donate to KBOO on Give Guide today at kboo.fm/give. Thanks.
To Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, law professor emeritus and attorney Marjorie Cohn discuss the latest on Trump's legal challenges as he attempts to invalidate the Biden-Harris win. And the Food and Drug Administration is chided by a federal court for approving genetically engineered salmon. The judge ruled on the side of environmentalists, but Aqua Bounty, a major player in the GE salmon business, said that the court's decision will have no impact on their ongoing operations. For our weekly Earth Watch, we speak with Amy Van Son, attorney, senior attorney in the Center for Food Safety's Portland, Oregon office. And a post-election message to the nation from the Reverend Dr. William Barber II. He is a co-coordinator of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, and president of Repairs of the Breach. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are going to start off our show today with just an incredible address to the nation given by the Reverend Dr. William Barber, who is a joint coordinator of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. He is also president of Repairs of the Breach. Now, the Poor People Campaign's Voting is Power Unleashed did a massive get out the vote effort across the United States, reaching approximately 3 million impoverished or low propensity voters. Their effort had an impact on the result. Very, very recently, Reverend Dr. Barber gave an address to the nation following the election, and we are going to bring you that sound now. Just to tell you a bit more about him, the Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II is the president and senior lecturer of Repairers of the Breach, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, A National Call for Moral Revival. He is a bishop with the Fellowship of Affirming Ministries and visiting professor at Union Theological Seminary. He is the pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church, Disciples of Christ in Goldsboro, North Carolina, and the author of 4 books. We are called to be a movement, Revive Us Again, Vision and Action in Moral Organizing, The Third Reconstruction, How a Moral Movement is Overcoming the Politics of Division and Fear, and Forward Together, A Moral Message for the Nation. Reverend Dr. Barber is also the architect of the Forward Together moral movement that gained national acclaim with its Moral Monday protests at the North Carolina General Assembly in 2013. Those weekly actions drew tens of thousands of North Carolinians and other moral witnesses to the state legislature. More than 1,200 peaceful protesters were arrested, handcuffed, and jailed. On September 12, 2016, Reverend Dr. Barber led a Moral Day of Action, the largest coordinating action on state capitals in U.S. history, calling for state governments to embrace a moral public policy agenda. On February 11, 2017, he led the largest moral march in North Carolina state history, with over 80,000 people calling on North Carolina's elected officials to embrace a moral public policy agenda. Now, the Poor People's Campaign was first called for by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King just months before his assassination, and indeed it did take place. It was the first occupation that we know of Washington, D.C., where a tent city, Resurrection City, was established. And just a few years ago, Reverend Dr. Barber, along with the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, they have started up again the Poor People's Campaign. And since then, it has spread. They have bases now in 45 states across the United States, urban and rural. It's multiracial, and it focuses on the interlocking evils, as they call it, of poverty, of racism, ecological devastation, the war economy, and the nation's distorted moral narrative. Let us go now to hear Reverend Dr. William Barber, his words following the election, the recent election.
Hello, my brothers and sisters across the nation. I'm Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, A National Call for Moral Revival. Earlier this year, we talked about how Frederick Douglass said in 1857, in the midst of great trauma to the abolition movement and great attempts to destroy it, he declared that the decisions that were made were monstrous. What the Supreme Court was doing, what the president was doing, what the marshals were doing, what the money and the pen and the purse, he said, were all organized against him. But then he turned the page and he said, but there's another view, there's another side. And then he concluded by saying, as monstrous as these decisions were, he met them with a cheerful spirit because he knew they did not have the last word. He also said that he knew that maybe these events were necessary links in the chain of events toward preparatory to the downfall of the entire situation. And he said that and didn't even have the right to vote. And people were enslaved. And all year long, we've been saying to people to stay steadfast, remember who we are. Today, as I come here, I remind you of that great psalm that says, wait on the Lord and be of good courage, and God will strengthen your heart. And wait there means to do what we've been assigned to do. Believe that through the work of justice and the work of love and the moral arc of the universe they do bend toward righteousness. But we have to do like a waiter who waits in a restaurant. We have to keep serving. keep doing the right thing. And we have to do it with courage. We said in 2017, when Donald Trump was first elected on watch night, we said bowing down would not be an option. And rather than crying and moaning, we went to work to build a Poor People's Campaign, not just for this election, but because we knew that we needed to build a campaign. We found out we had 140 million other people that needed the campaign, 43% of this nation. We found out that 4 million people get up every morning, can buy unleaded gas and can't buy unleaded water. We found out that racism, as it affects Black people, brown people, Asian people, indigenous people, all needed to be connected together. We found out that we were spending $800 billion a year on the war economy. And if we just cut that in half, we would have still have more money than North Korea, China, Russia, Iran, and Iraq. So we went to work. And so here we are in November of 2020. And I want to, like Frederick Douglass, meet this moment with a cheerful spirit and say that what we are seeing happening right now, even as the returns are yet to fully come in, is the beginning of the end of an illusion. You know, since Donald Trump eked out an Electoral College vote in 2016, he has proudly, every time he could, displayed a U.S. map that highlights in red the counties he won, despite losing the national popular vote to Hillary Clinton by more than 3 million votes. Oh, he has been as pompous as Nebuchadnezzar in the Bible. And the point of the map, like a financial statement, he used it for years to apply for credit, to claim legitimacy, to declare he had a mandate to do the extreme things he and his marauding band of politicians and enablers. This was a president who had never had the support of the majority of the Americans. He pretended, created an illusion to represent most of the country, even though he was only in the White House by 80,000 votes from an area where 2.6 million poor and low-wealth people had not even voted. The red mirage, though, was not something created by Trump. It has always been an illusion. And an illusion can be that for years now could have been broken if we dared to organize fusion coalitions among poor and low-wealth people. And that is our work. In Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, Republican legislatures fought hard to help Trump maintain this appearance of legitimacy on election night. They did it by delaying the counting of overwhelmingly Democratic mail-in ballots. They tried. But elections are not decided by candidates or state legislators. In a democracy, elections are decided by the people. Donald Trump did not create, though, this myth of the red electoral map. He simply exploited it. The map was created, the idea was created in 1968, some 52 years ago, when Republican strategists went in to Richard Nixon and declared that the way to win would be to create something called positive polarization, to pit some Americans against their neighbors in so-called battleground states, to deliberately split the country for political gain, especially from Maryland to Nevada, the South, and the so-called Sun Belt. All Trump did was exploit this. All McConnell has done for years have exploited it. Trump's extremism has revealed a larger and more diverse electorate, though, that has the power to reshape priorities in American public life. And this is not so much due to Democrats, because Democrats have sometimes given in to the exploitation. They've accepted the illusion, and they've created so-called blue walls. But this movement, we said, is not a blue wall or a red wall. It's fusion coalitions. Is lifting up poor and low-wealth people around an agenda and in a movement who choose to not only vote, but then once they vote, to challenge those in power. So now where are we? More than 72 million Americans have voted this year to repudiate extremism, racism, Trumpism. Trumpism that comes out of extremism. And fusion coalitions from Wisconsin to Pennsylvania to Michigan, North Carolina, and Georgia have demonstrated their power by making races too close to call, even in Arizona and Nevada. These are places where some of them, where years, just a few years ago, the call would have been easy. We are seeing the beginnings of the complete falling of the Southern strategy. And guess what, Poor People's Campaign? You are right in the middle of it and a major cause of it. Because what we understand now is that from living wages to health care to immigration to climate crisis and to really dealing with the issues of racism, voter suppression, police brutality, mass incarceration, these pressing issues we face are not red or blue issues, but they're moral issues, and they're all connected, and they compel us to face who we are as a nation and who we want to be as a nation. And this election has revealed that while the forces of extremist division are strong, because there's always going to be some division between justice and injustice, the first goal of our Constitution is not even unity, it's the establishment of justice, for providing for the common defense, ensuring and promoting the general welfare. And then if you do those things, you can ensure domestic tranquility. But domestic tranquility is not first. Justice is first. But the forces of extremism have had this illusion, but fusion coalitions are showing the possibility of a genuine democracy is stronger still. And our task now is to build together an America that works for all of us. So many people are talking about the nation being divided, and it is. When hasn't it been? But it's not evenly divided. That's the point. Extremism has exploited our deep wounds, but it's not evenly divided. That's why even the Constitution, even the flawed Electoral College doesn't say you have to get all the Electoral College votes. It says 270, which means there's going to be division. But we know that we don't have to exploit the division. We can build fusion coalitions, which is the only way to really heal the nation is to address poverty and systemic racism. If we address poverty, systemic racism, ecological devastation, the war economy, and the false moral narrative, religious nationalism, then that is the key to the healing of the nation. And it will not bring everybody along, but it will bring so many along that they become a force for moving us forward than a force for moving us backwards. And the coronavirus pandemic, as we pray for all those who are suffering, it has not impacted the Americans equally. According to an analysis by the Center for Disease Control, poor people are three times as likely to contract COVID-19, not poor black people, white, but just poor people. Of course, poor black people in percentage are more likely, and Latino and indigenous, but poor people are three times more likely to contract. And when they do, and their families are not able to quarantine and skip work. Poverty has not only made the pandemic worse, racism has made it worse, but poverty has fueled our public health crisis, as many service workers have continued to show up for work even when they suspect they may be infected with the virus because they have no other way to survive. This is the division we ought to be talking about. Not the division between McConnell and Schumer. Not the cute division that people want to talk about, can't everybody just get along? No, when injustice is alive. As one of the great writers in our society, James Baldwin, taught us, we can have disagreement until your disagreement suggests my right to exist. We can even have unity unless your unity makes me have to agree. In order to be unified with you, I have to agree that I don't have the right to exist. False unity can never be a cop-out for justice, and addressing poverty and systemic racism is the way to bring domestic tranquility. we have to challenge those forces that would rather not deal with that. We cannot agree with them and unify with them if the price of the unity is not addressing the issue of poverty. In the face of this painful reality, when the poor are being affected more during this pandemic, something's happening. Americans increasingly are supporting policies that address poverty because so many are falling into poverty. Support has increased even among Republicans who have historically been less supported. Take living wages, for example. 7 in 10 Americans support raising the minimum wage now, according to a recent IPOS poll. Before the pandemic, only 48% of Republicans backed this anti-poverty measure. But in late August, 62% of Republicans said they support raising the minimum wage. So the key to unifying is not just holding hands, not just agreeing to the extremism, but addressing poverty and addressing systemic racism. Universal access to health care is another anti-poverty measure that a growing majority of Americans support. Despite the Trump administration's attack on the Affordable Care Act, its expansion of health care to 25 million Americans continues to remain popular. Ahead of this year's election, 63% of Americans said the government has a responsibility to make sure everybody has health care. So there's even support for universal health care. That's a 4% increase since last year. So at the very time extremists are trying to give us the illusion that people don't want health care, the people are in a very different place. And that's going to be the key for anybody in leadership, is not to kowtow to the extremists to try to unify with them, but to unite with the people, particularly poor and low-wealth people, and make this democracy work for everybody, because that's the real division we should address. When asked if the government has a responsibility to provide health care for the poor and elderly, even a majority of Republicans agree. That's why our work now is more important than ever, because we are right. Fusion moral coalitions that lift and deal with issues affecting the poor, the 5 core issues we have lifted up, are the key to the healing of this nation. They have even been the key to many people turning out to vote. No doubt this election has highlighted deep divisions in our common life. Many of those that have been regularly exploited by the wealthy few. But this is not new. It's not new. This business of let's get back to place of pristine unity, when? This is not new. The long story of inequality in America is that race, politics, and cultural wedge issues have been deployed consistently to divide and conquer coalitions of Native, Black, White, Brown, and Asian Americans who have pushed this nation to guarantee equal treatment under the law and an economy that works for everyone. And those wounds don't go away when we commit to tackle poverty, but there is the promise that they can heal when we recognize that some things are not about left versus right, but are about right versus wrong. And it is wrong that nearly half the citizens in the richest nation of the world continue to struggle with the ends meet, 140 million and growing. And addressing that is the key to healing America and finishing the illusion of division and polarization. Ending poverty is the moral issue that can and must unite us all. I mean, think about it. Here we are today, and a candidate, a white older man, and a Black woman with roots in India have gotten 72 plus million votes, more than any time in history. Think about that. In the middle of a pandemic, and they didn't fully embrace the poor people's agenda. That's for us to make. But both of them were at our Congress in 2019 when we lifted up a moral budget and committed to address poverty. They were at our recent gathering September 14th. The vice president was, and declared that ending poverty was center to his understanding and philosophy of change. And they've dared to run on 15 and a union, expanding healthcare and talking about systemic racism. And they got 72 million votes so far, more than any team in history. What if, when they govern, they truly decide to address poverty in the Moral Jubilee budget and to tap into the 64 million poor and low wealth people that are eligible to vote and address the 140 million that were in poverty before the pandemic? My God, if you can get this many votes just doing 15 in the union, healthcare, and talking about systemic racism, and they would not be there if it was not for movements and the Poor People's Campaign, the Fight 15. No. Be clear about this. And what did we do in this election? We didn't just sit back. We contacted 2.3 million. Liz will talk about it more, 2.3 million. We did that. And over 400,000, 20% voted early. And in the states that right now is too close to call, we touched 1.5 million poor and low wealth people and said, join the movement and vote. We didn't even invite them to vote for candidates. We invited them to vote for a movement and to look at the candidate through the lens of the movement and vote and look at what we're seeing in Philadelphia, Michigan, and Wisconsin, in Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia, and North Carolina, all places where we, the Poor People's Campaign, went to work. And we did this. We didn't even have our mass Poor People's Assembly Moral March on Washington yet. It's going to happen. Thousands of people in the street around these issues, yes. We've not even yet pushed our Jubilee Justice agenda in state houses and the United States Congress. That's to come. And already, we're showing the nation the way. You want to be healed? You got to address poverty, systemic poverty, racism, ecological devastation, the war economy. Now, some are saying, well, because the Senate may have stayed the same, and some are saying the politicians aren't going to do this. Let me tell you, don't forget, we're in the middle of a pandemic. People are hurting. We might not hear it right now because of the election, but people are dying, still dying, 1,000 a day dying. 100,000 getting infected. And the people are not going to stand for that. They're not going to stand for a new administration. I don't care what their party is, not addressing these issues. So the politicians don't get to act on us, because we're not going to merely be spectators. We are participants. So all the talking heads that are saying, oh, it's going to be this and they're going to do this, they're looking backwards. They're not looking forward. They're not looking at what the movement is going to do. People took time to vote. Now that they voted, and when this comes in, people are going to be engaged, because we're not going to let Congress people sit up in the United States Congress with health care and protection and living wages and people not have the same thing. Don't you forget, my brothers and sisters, that we are called to be a movement. Not just to be in an election, but to be a movement. But because you moved in this election, you are seeing in front of you the ending of the illusion, the beginnings of it, the very beginnings of a third reconstruction. And that's your work. Now we got to stay at it. We got to keep building fusing coalitions, keep building fusing coalitions. Even the closeness of the races in the South, if they don't turn out exactly like some would like, the closeness is a sign of the ending of the illusion. That's why we got to keep organizing, keep moving, keep fighting. And remember, we are not of those who shrink back unto destruction, but we are those who persevere unto the salvation of the soul. Faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. So my brothers and sisters in the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, and to all of you across the nation who are listening, we know the answer to the healing. Address poverty, address systemic racism, address ecological devastation, the war economy. And we may not end all of the divisions, but healing can come in this nation, because if justice comes, healing is present. If promoting the general welfare comes, healing is present. If caring for the least of these, healing is present. And all may not come, but those who come and those who are healed will be far more than enough to keep pushing this nation in the right paths of justice and righteousness and love and truth. And never forget, forward, together, and not one step back.
Fantastic presentation to the nation by the Reverend Dr. William J. Barber, who is a co-coordinator of the Poor People's Campaign, A National Call for Moral Revival. He called on us to be a movement, not just participants in an election, and to build fusion coalitions. He says we are those who persevere, and that if justice comes, healing comes. And to care for the least of these, if we care for the least of these, justice also comes. You could get more information about Reverend Barber on the Poor People's Campaign website and also the website of Repairers of the Breach. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a short break. And coming up, our weekly Earth Watch, what's going on with the FDA getting slapped down by a judge saying the FDA had no business approving genetically engineered salmon, and also Trump's continuing legal battles to stop Biden and Harris from being seated as president and vice president. Attorney Marjorie Cohn breaks it down for us. Don't go away. You won't want to miss that. We'll be right back.
We who believe in freedom and that
one of my favorites, Ella's Song by Sweet Honey and the Rock. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check out our website at sotrueradio.org and our handle on Instagram and Twitter at sotrueradio. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us there. And we're also nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud, a growing national and worldwide audience. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our Sojourner Truth listeners in Blacksburg, Virginia, And internationally, we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the Ukraine, quite a lot of SoundCloud listeners in the Ukraine. So, on Thursday, November the 5th, the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California ruled the Food and Drug Administration, known as the FDA, violated core environmental laws in approving genetically engineered salmon. The court ruled that the FDA ignored the serious environmental consequences of approving genetically engineered salmon and the full extent of plans to grow and commercialize the salmon in the United States and around the world in violation, they say, of the National Environmental Policy Act. Now, in 2016, the Center for Food Safety and Earth Justice sued the FDA for approving the first ever commercially genetically engineered animal, the Atlantic salmon, engineered to grow twice as fast as its wild counterpart. Now, the genetically engineered salmon was produced by Aqua Bounty Technologies, Inc., with DNA from Atlantic salmon, Pacific king salmon, and Arctic ocean eel point. So to break all this down for us, I'd like to welcome our guest, Amy Vanson, senior attorney in the Center for Food Safety's Portland, Oregon office. As part of their legal team, Amy practices environmental and administrative law to defend farmers, communities, and the environment from industrial animal factories, aquaculture, genetically engineered crops and animals, and the overuse of toxic pesticides, especially in the Pacific Northwest. Amy is a graduate of Lewis and Clark Law School and focused her career on public interest, environmental, and food law to fight for a just and restorative food system. Amy Van Somme, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
And we also want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. We partner with them for our weekly Earth Minute and our weekly Earth Watch. So, Amy, first, just tell us what your concerns were and the other plaintiffs, and also tell us who were some of the other plaintiffs in your lawsuit. But what's the problem with genetically engineered salmon?
Well, the major problem with genetically engineered salmon is in part with the aquaculture of any salmon, which is that if they escape from their confinement, they can have really devastating impacts on the wild fish, especially wild relatives. And what's even scarier with the genetically engineered salmon is that, you know, it supposedly grows twice as fast, and that once that novel organism gets introduced into the environment, there's no way to call it back. And there are extra concerns with the release of transgenic or genetically engineered fish into the environment. As I said, we already know the devastating effects that can happen when farmed fish are released, but it is extra problematic when it's a new type of organism. And, you know, to drill down a little bit, just the types of harms here are, you know, when fish escape, they can compete with other fish for resources, for mating. They can, if they can successfully mate, they can, you know, what's called genetic introgression, where they would actually impact the genetics and, you know, future line of that wild fish. They can also spread disease and parasites, and so they can have really devastating impacts. And the wild Atlantic salmon is critically endangered, and so that was the major concern. So some of our other plaintiffs are conservation groups and recreation groups, recreational fishing and commercial fishing groups. So, and as well as the Quinault Indian Nation. So, you know, their concerns for salmon are deeply cultural and spiritual, and salmon being an incredibly important part of that tribe and other indigenous peoples, you know, lives and cultures. So the potential effects there are can't be overstated.
Yeah, and just is there a difference? I mean, tell us, because we know this is genetically engineered salmon. We've also on this show talked about genetically modified foods, GMOs, and what's the difference between those two?
There is no difference. It's just a difference in terms. We use the term genetically engineered because we believe it's more accurate and, you know, it's a little bit more specific, but when people say genetically modified, they also usually are meaning using the genes from you know, another organism that, you know, could never sexually reproduce. So yeah, they're the same meaning.
Right. Now, this was a big deal, according to your website. It's saying that the U.S. basically would have been, the FDA would have been the first government agency in the world to approve a genetically engineered food or animal for sale and human consumption. So I imagine that part of the issue with this is what's next. We've covered this show, for example, the dangers of genetically engineered trees, you know, and other GMO foods. But this seems to be a slippery slope. If you're going to approve genetically engineered salmon, then what's next? Will it be farm animals? I mean, what's the story here? And why do you think the federal court ruled with environmentalists on this?
Well, it's certainly a very precedential approval. And so we've seen and we've been fighting the impacts from genetically engineered plants, as you said, for decades already. And so this was the first GE animal to be approved for human consumption. FDA has done some limited approvals for GE animals that produce human drugs, but those are much more limited, you know, types of production. This is the first widespread commercial approval and for us to eat. And, it, you know, it's especially worrisome because this is a wild animal that, you know, it migrates thousands of miles. So unlike, you know, GE corn or soy, which we do know, in fact, gets out of the fields it's grown and contaminates other crops, these animals, if they were to be released, could get out and go much farther. And what is next is certainly more GE fish. We know that those are in the pipeline. And even more terrifyingly, animals, like you said, farmed animals, like, you know, pigs or chickens that they say they want to engineer in order to fit into our factory system for producing animals. And, you know, so that has widespread implications. And we have no federal laws that directly regulate or deal with this, you know, brave new world of genetic engineering. So instead, various federal agencies have taken pieces of authority based on their existing laws. And so here FDA was using the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which is, you know, from the, 1920s, and trying to fit their drug authority, you know, to approve these animals. So it's a, you know, mismatch there that was part of the claims in the case. Unfortunately, the court did rule in an earlier order that the FDA's authority is broad enough over drugs that it would encompass genetically engineered animals. However, the court did not buy, and this gets to the second part of your question, you know, why did the court rule for the environmentalists and the fishermen and women here and the tribes, is that, you know, just didn't buy that FDA could stop its risk assessment at, you know, the fish won't get out. Basically, what FDA did was just assess the likelihood that they might escape from the land-based facilities that they're going to be grown in, and didn't do the second part of the analysis, which is what happens if they do get out, and what might happen to wild salmon if these fish establish in the wild. He also did not buy that the company wasn't, you know, that the expansion of this company was not before FDA and should have been part of the analysis, and that really highlights the importance of this first ever, you know, approval, that FDA needs to do the full and robust, you know, environmental risk assessment, because we know there's going to be expansion by the company. They've in fact already closed their Panama facility and opened a facility that's much larger in Indiana.
Well, let me ask you this, because we just have about a minute or so, because at this company, they're saying that this ruling really won't have any impact on their ongoing operations. They've got an operation in Canada. They're also in Indiana, and I think they also are talking about Kentucky, or may already be in Kentucky. What do they mean? Do they mean that they have every confidence that they could challenge this ruling, or that even in the face of this ruling, they could go right ahead with what they're doing?
Well, the court, while the court held that the FDA failed to comply with these environmental laws, including the Endangered Species Act, you know, for wild endangered salmon, the court did not actually vacate the approval. So it held the approval unlawful, but it didn't say that the growth and, you know, sales of these fish had to stop in the meantime while FDA goes back and redoes its analysis. So the company is certainly happy about that. They can keep going with their production. However, FDA has to do more analysis, and it will have to make a new decision in terms of, you know, will it continue the approval or would it condition it further? So, you know, it's not over. And we're not sure if either of the government or Aqua Bounty will try to appeal the ruling or whether we will, given that it is strange to not put a halt to the production of these fish when we don't know what their impact might be on critically endangered wild Atlantic salmon.
Yeah, Amy, I'm afraid we are out of time, but quickly, for people who want to find out more about this story and to support your efforts, what should they do? Is there a website they can go to?
Yes, you can go to our website at www.centerforfoodsafety.org, and that's centerforfoodsafety.org, and sign up for our updates and join our mailing list, free to join, and we will certainly be updating our members on this case and our other important work.
All righty. Amy Van Zoon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Have a good day.
All righty. And now the elections and the ongoing legal battles. Marjorie Cohn waiting to speak with us. Let's just go to a short clip from, of all places, Fox News. They seem to be changing their tune slightly. Let's go to that clip now.
Mr. Vice President, is it time to concede? Is there really any evidence of fraud?
Vice President Mike Pence ignoring questions as to whether President Trump should concede the election to President-elect Joe Biden. While overturning the current vote count looks to be a big hill to climb for the president, his efforts are getting support from some of the most senior members of his own party. The Trump campaign continuing to collect affidavits and sworn declarations from election workers detailing what they insist is evidence of voter fraud. All documents have been forwarded to the Justice Department. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell saying people need to stop panicking.
I think we ought to quit all the hand-wringing and not act like this is extraordinary. We're going to get through this period, and we'll swear in the winner on January the 20th, 2021, just like we have every 4 years since 1793.
He did not say who that would be. Meanwhile, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says there is no path to victory for President Trump, adding this is not a single state narrow margin like in 2000 with Florida.
These are many states where there are tens of thousands of votes different, and the Republicans have no legal case.
Meanwhile, Trump supporters are holding a march called the Million MAGA March this weekend in Washington, D.C.
Million MAGA March. Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, where she taught for several decades. She's the former president of the National Lawyers Guild, criminal defense attorney, legal scholar, political analyst, writes books and articles. Her most recent book, Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. She's provided commentary for most of the major news networks, television, radio, etc. Marjorie Cohn, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Margaret.
Okay, so last time you were on, we talked about these lawsuits. Trump has lawsuits in Pennsylvania, Michigan, as well as Arizona, Georgia. They now have announced that they're going to be doing a recount by hand of their elections. And the Wall Street Journal is, and I'll quote them, they're saying that one potential strategy discussed by Trump's legal team would be attempting to get court orders to delay vote certification in critical states, potentially positioning Republican-controlled state legislatures to appoint pro-Trump electors who would swing the Electoral College in his favor. So two things for you to address. Tell us where things are with these lawsuits, and then your take on this strategy, that the strategy really is trying to get these conservative legislatures to decide who the president will be. Marjorie Cohn.
Yes, Margaret, for months before the election, Trump mounted a concerted strategy to preemptively discredit the election results by spewing unfounded accusations of voter fraud. There really has been no massive voter fraud, and that's pretty much the conclusion of everyone who studied it. And so he wanted to sow the seeds of doubt about mail ballots, knowing that mostly Democrats would send in mail ballots, because he told his supporters to go to the polls. And so on election night, it looked like he was winning. And then as the mail-in ballots were counted, then Biden took over. And Trump said, oh, they're stealing the election. I was ahead. What's happening? Most of the lawsuits are really frivolous that he's filed. In fact, all of them are. None of them would overturn the results of the election. There is one in Pennsylvania where he was disputing whether or not they could count the votes that were received by Election Day but didn't come in until the 6th because of the Postal Service problems. And the Supreme Court, three justices on the Supreme Court, Alito, Gorsuch, and Thomas, look like they might be open to that. But what this strategy of filing these frivolous lawsuits and screaming voter fraud is really aimed at is stealing the election from Joe Biden. And this was also floated by Republicans before the election, that Republican-friendly legislatures in, for example, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania could ignore the popular vote and appoint their own electors. And the federal law allows legislatures to do that if the states have failed to make a choice by December 14th, which is the day the Electoral College meets. And so shortly after the election, the top Republican in the Pennsylvania State Senate said his party's going to follow the law. It's going to be decided by the outcome of the popular vote. But on Tuesday, Republicans in the Pennsylvania legislature said they wanted to investigate allegations of voter fraud. And the Republican-led legislatures in Michigan and Wisconsin are doing the same. And in Pennsylvania and Michigan, Trump's campaign is trying to block officials from certifying the results because the federal law says that as long as the election results are finalized by the 8th of December, then the result is conclusive. So by dragging out the process, asking courts to extend the deadlines for the states, that gives them more wiggle room. Now, the other wrinkle is that Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Nevada all have Democratic governors who would not approve a set of Trump electors if the state legislatures said we're going to give you our own electors, give the Electoral College our own electors, and ignore the popular vote. So then, if there were dueling sets of electors, it would fall to Congress. There could be a dispute between the House and the Senate. The Supreme Court could step in. Under the Constitution, the Trump and Pence's terms both end at noon on January 20th, and if there's no president decided by then, Nancy Pelosi would become president. Now, in addition, Trump has, in order to create this perception of fraud, to give these Republican legislatures political cover to send in their Trump electors and try to steal the election from Joe Biden, he got his Attorney General, Bill William Barr, to authorize federal prosecutors to investigate, quote, substantial allegations of voting and vote tabulation irregularities, unquote. They won't find any substantial allegations, even with these declarations that they're soliciting, but it also creates the perception, at least among the Republican legislatures and Trump's base, who will be in the streets, of massive voter fraud. Barr said after the election there wasn't any massive voter fraud, but he capitulated to Trump's pressure. And Donald Trump fired Defense Secretary Esper because he opposed the use of the Insurrection Act to use troops against protesters. Remember on June 1st when they used tear gas and chemical weapons to clear peaceful protesters out of Lafayette Park in Washington, D.C. for Trump's photo op with his Bible in front of the church. And Donald Trump knows that if there's a popular uprising, he wants loyalists to take on the protesters. Now, of course, the question is the military, I mean, these are civilian people that he is replacing in the Department of Defense, Esper and others who are, and replacing them with Trump loyalists, but will the military carry out unlawful orders to steal the election? That may be what it comes down to. There is a duty to obey lawful orders and a duty to disobey unlawful orders. So that's one thing. The other thing is, what would the Supreme Court do if this whole electoral conflict reached them? And of course, Trump has always said that he wanted Amy Barrett on the court so that she could hand him the election, and it may come down to the Supreme Court. So there is no doubt in my mind, Margaret, that Trump's concerted strategy with his accomplices, with his collaborators, with his aiders and abettors, Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, and, you know, many other Republicans now, Bill Barr, are trying to steal the election from Joe Biden. This is going to be a big mess for the next 2 months.
Right. So those who are dancing on the street better pay attention. Marjorie Cohn, we are out of time, but you're going to have to come back because this is a saga that's going to continue here. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret.
Okay, we are out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank all of today's guests and our audio engineer today, Kiana Williams, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, and you all, please, stay safe.
KBOO Portland. KBOO is excited to be part of the Willamette Week Give Guide this year. When you support KBOO through Give Guide, not only does it support your favorite community radio station, it also gives you a little back in